Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Dr. Trudy Meehan, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Trudy, you've been on the show with us before, kind of in your role as a clinical psychologist at the Royal College of Surgeons. But what you're going to talk about this morning is a lot more personal for you. So you've written a beautiful picture book called The Way Home, and it's to help young children who have experienced the suicide of a loved one, and it's dedicated to your daughter Mira, who's now 10. So take me back 8 years ago to 2017. So you and Mira had left the family home because your marriage had broken down irreparably. You were in the process of formally separating. What happened then?
So I found myself with my two eldest brothers being the first people on the scene of a suicide. And unfortunately, it was the suicide of Mira's dad. And so, and I think that's the short version of the story.
How did the day unfold?
There's lots of very significant points in the day, but I think for me, having been in lots of therapy since, what I realised was one of the most significant points in the day for me was when the first responder, the paramedic, arrived on the scene and really saved me and my siblings from the horror and the responsibility of managing everything and trying to save and rescue. And I think we were on the edge of falling apart when somebody like a hero just arrived, and I think they don't get enough credit.
And they kicked in, a process kicks in.
A process kicks in,
And you feel suddenly like you're held and you're okay.
Exactly. As you're about to fall apart, they came just in time.
I can imagine. And Mira was just 2 at that point.
Yeah.
So where was she as the day played out?
So luckily she had started her day in the normal, kind of going off to her creche. And in the way of like most Irish bereavements, family and neighbours and friends kicked in. So my niece stepped in and took Mira off for the day and just looked after her as if she was having a normal day with the cousin having a play date. And, everything was normal for her at that stage. Then in my family home, my parents' home, Irish funeral time kicks in. People started arriving at the house and, offering support. And I think, again, another key point and a saving grace for me, my nephew and his wife, who was his fiance at the time, they just stopped me at the front door before I walked in. And they said, you need to get out of here. You need some space before you walk into all those people.
Yeah.
And they took me off and drove me around in the car and just allowed me to feel what I was feeling without having to perform or put on a brave face for everybody. And that was amazing.
Yeah. And I presume they gave you the space. The fact that Mira was off with her cousin gave you the space to think about what you say to Mira.
Exactly.
She was 2. Yeah. But you had to tell her, did you, that her dad was saying?
Exactly. And like I knew, because being a clinical psychologist, and at the time I was working in the HSE with young people, and many of them had lost parents to suicide. So I knew what I needed to do. And the right thing to do is to tell the young person as quickly as possible, as honestly as possible, and in a concrete, age-appropriate way.
So what did you say to her?
So I said to her, and to be 100% honest, I can't remember how I led into the story, but I remember the words because I had practiced them so much. And I said to her that her dad had died and that his heart had stopped working. And that it was a little bit like when the battery stops working in her toys. The toy can't move, it can't make noise, it does not work anymore. And I said, but unlike batteries, a heart cannot be replaced. Once it stops working, the thing that had the heart can never work again. And I said, her dad's body will never work again. It won't move, he won't make noise, he won't be able to breathe. And that's what it means to be dead.
And do you think she, did she understand, okay, he's gone and he's not coming back?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think she, knowing developmentally, she would have understood the concept of stopped working.
Okay.
And that there was something lost. But children at that age, they can't conceptualize the duration of, or the yes. finality.
Yes.
And I know that a few months afterwards, she asked me, was her daddy in work? And I had to make the decision then, you know, it's so easy just to lie and say, yes, he's in work. But I know the right answer was to say, and then I had to repeat it. No, remember, your dad's dead, and go through the story again. And I think that's the hardest thing for people.
Yeah. And what was her reaction that first day?
Yeah. And again, I don't have a clear reaction, a clear memory of her yeah. reaction. I know that she had kind of a, and that's her, and that's a 2-year-old response, and almost matter of fact, just taking in the facts. And when I thought more about her reaction, what I remember, she did cry a lot at that time, but the crying wasn't a typical crying that you see in a child. It was almost a collapse, where she would collapse so hard that there wasn't even energy for crying. There would be a whimper.
Yeah, yeah. That's hard to look at,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
So with your professional hat on then, would you have looked at that very, very difficult conversation yeah. and her response to it and everything? Was it all appropriate and healthy and as it should be? Was it?
Yeah, and yeah. that's the thing. And I suppose I was, to say I was lucky sounds a bit strange, but I had the benefit of seeing her reacting and knowing it was horrible, but also knowing that it was absolutely the right thing and the only correct thing to do. And the fact that I did it and got through it and it seemed to be the right thing, you yeah. know, it was comforting.
Were you torn then about Mira seeing her dad's body?
Yeah, I suppose I knew that children should be included in the rituals and in seeing the body after a death. But the people around me really thought it was awful idea to, you know, bring her down and see her dad in the coffin at the funeral home. And, you know, even myself and my mum had a huge row in the kitchen, and my mum was going, you can't, you just can't bring a child to a funeral home. And I said, look, mum, as a mum, I have no idea what to do. I have no idea. But as a psychologist, I know this is what the books say. And that's the only information I have. So I'm going to go with that information.
Because the instinct as a parent is possibly to protect
exactly.
her from that. Yeah.
Exactly. And to avoid something like that. But I just, all I knew, the only right step I knew was what the book said.
Yeah.
So I went with that. And as I went into the funeral home, we happened to bump into the funeral director. And he just stopped and he said, thank goodness you're bringing her in. He said, I'm sick telling people to bring children to the funeral home. They have to be involved, and it's much better for them to be involved in the process.
And do you remember how it was for her?
Yeah. And I was terrified of this process because I had no idea how she would react. And I was scared that she would, you know, think he was just asleep and want to wake him up. Luckily, that didn't happen. And what I saw with her was she instinctively knew there was a huge difference.
Yeah.
And she said to me, that's not my dad. And I understood what she meant by that, that, you know, she knew that he was gone. And so she didn't try and wake him or, you know, reach him in any way. And she pulled away slightly. And I guess
kids are a lot more sophisticated than we think.
That's the thing. You know, they're more sophisticated. They feel, you know, we all have instinctive responses to death. And, you know, we're biological creatures and we're wired to respond to death.
Yeah.
And she had an appropriate response. You know, and she also knew how I was feeling, and they pick up on everybody around them. So we can't hide what's happening. And when we do, okay. it's more confusing because they can feel adults in distress and they have to make meaning of that. And if we don't help them make meaning, then they've just their imaginary world to fall back on.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Because so I'm thinking of the funeral then. Did Mira go to the funeral? Because I remember as a kid, remember the first time you ever went to a funeral? Yeah. And people were really sad, but there were also people chatting and laughing and everything, and it was so confusing.
Exactly. And, you know, it's all of those emotions together. And in this instance, she didn't go to the funeral. And ideally, I think she probably could have. But for me, because as the person in charge of being the one organising and leading the procedures and all of the funeral events, I knew I couldn't manage holding her emotions appropriately and holding everybody else as well.
Yeah.
So you did have
a little funeral yourselves later.
Later. And that was so interesting for me as a parent, but also as a psychologist, to know that children know what they need if we can listen to them properly.
Okay.
And years later, she obviously got to see other funerals and graves, and she saw that other people had graves to go to and to say goodbye or to speak to their loved ones. And she asked for a grave for her dad. And I have to say, at the time, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to pull this off. And, you know, it was one of the strangest things I'd ever had to organise.
Yeah.
But we did it, and we talked to the priest and the people in the graveyard organising things, and we got a grave for her dad and a place for her to take part in that ritual. And we had a mini funeral where, you know, a small number of people came and allowed her to have her funeral to say goodbye to her dad.
Wow. So look, so far, a lot of that will be familiar to anyone who's had to mind a child through the death of a parent. You obviously had this added complication of it being suicide. So what age was Mira when you thought about broaching that aspect of things with her?
Yeah, I knew immediately that I needed to do it.
Like quickly?
Yeah, like I knew in theory I should do it quickly. I wasn't able to. I didn't know the words. And I suppose just thinking about the gravestone and the burial, her dad had been cremated, which is why there was no grave. So just if people were confused around that. But in terms of the talking to her about suicide, in theory, I should have done it straight away. I should have included the word suicide in the description of how he died.
Really? At two?
Yeah. But I didn't have the skill, and I wasn't up on the research. And so about 6 months in, I knew I was running out of time. It probably, in my memory, it was 6 months, but I think realistically it was a year. Time bends in these situations. But definitely at a year, I knew I was running out of time. And you run out of time because in a community, everybody knows what's happened, and the word suicide is around. But also there's an inquest, and I knew as soon as she could read and write and type, she would be on the internet Googling. And all the information is available. So, and I wanted her to hear about it in a safe place, and the safest place for her is me. So I decided about a year later to explain suicide to her.
Okay, I'm trying to cast my mind back to a three-year-old child. So, like, how were you able to explain it to her?
Yeah.
What did you say?
So I explained to her that, and I suppose I leaned on a simple version of suicide, and I'm conscious there's a suicide is just like death. There's as many ways to die by suicide as there is to die. But I chose a simple story of, and I said, look, I told you your dad's heart stopped working, but his brain was also not working properly. And he had a disease in his brain, and that disease is called depression. And when you have depression, it impacts on your brain, and it makes your thinking really mixed up and very confused. And it makes your body feel lots of pain, so much pain and so much confusion that you decide to stop your heart working and you end your life. And when you decide to end your life like that, that's called suicide.
And how did she react to that? Did she have questions?
Yeah.
I mean, why must be the first question, which is the first question a child has in a lot of situations.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And her first one was, and it was a really tough one for me. Why didn't you send him to the doctor? Why didn't you make him take his medication? You know?
Right.
And you can't blame the other person. you know, so you can't say everybody tried and we did and, you know, so I, you know, you take the hit, you know, you just say everybody tried and did their best and, you know, but it's
But you have to get the tone right and not wanting.
Yeah, you don't want to blame the person who died, you know, and so it's a balance. And I suppose I knew from working with adolescents that there was a bigger why coming. And that why was much harder to answer.
And tell me what that why is.
That why was, but ma'am, if he loved me so much, then why did he leave me? And that haunted me. And I didn't, thankfully she didn't ask me that then, because the 3-year-olds don't think in such a complex way. It's on, you know, it's immediate. Their questions are concrete.
When did that question come?
Luckily, it hasn't come yet.
Okay.
And hopefully it won't come. And I suppose that's why I started writing the book, as a way to get ahead of her.
Yeah. And just before we come to the book, one more question on that, because I think this is really, really invaluable for people. Did she have more questions as time went on? Like, would every now and again, would it be on her mind and she'd have things?
Yeah, yeah. And her questions, they come and go. And I think people really need to understand that about children and their capacity to engage, even when they have a question. They'll take your answer and then you try to go deeper. They usually don't want to.
Okay.
You know, and I would be like just getting warmed up, you know, and like she's ready to talk and then she'd be off changing the subject.
Okay. And that's okay.
That's okay. Yeah. Kids, they take like death and grief and sadness, they're so huge and they only have a capacity for so much, but also they live in the moment. So they're really good at going, okay, I feel sad here, but there's something over there that's really good and I'm going to go to that good thing now. And it's very healthy. They hold conflicting emotions together in a way that adults can't.
Right.
So they can hold the good alongside the bad. And that's, if we could do that as adults, we would be so much better off.
Yeah.
But it can be confusing as the adult and you think they're cold or maybe there's something wrong with them that they're not, you know, feeling enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So the book then, when did you decide to write the book?
Yeah, it was a long process. I think probably once I started telling her about suicide, I started looking for answers for the why, you know, if he loved me so much. And I asked bereavement experts and, you know, they said the answer is you can never know why. And I thought, oh God, that's not a good answer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Mira's hugely inquisitive and curious and she's clever and she will find the answer to her whys. And it also felt professional and cold. And I just thought it's not good enough. So I thought, okay, I need to find a way to answer this myself. There wasn't a resource. And I went through all the books and got all the, you know, the picture books in the library and that I could find. And she would always slump at the end of the book. And it felt to me like she felt alone, because the books, they were talking about a different kind of loss, you know, like a granny or somebody who died at a predictable time. And there was a way to hold the bond and continue the bond.
And everything worked out fine at the end, I presume.
You know, I just felt like she was very much alone. And it tied in with the taboo around suicide. And a lot of people bereaved by suicide, I think, feel isolated and tainted or something. And I really didn't want her to feel alone in her loss. So the book came slowly. And a friend of mine is also a psychologist, Sarah Robinson, and she talked about taboo. And she said, we know with taboo subjects, we need community resources that are available and not something in a private, like in the clinic that you talk to behind closed doors, or a book that's on the top shelf. The best way to deal with shame and taboo is to make it just a normal story.
Yeah.
You know?
And I was saying to you that when I was coming into the book, I was going, oh God, what's she at here now? Is this, how is this going to work out? And actually, it's so elegant and beautiful, the metaphor you use to tell the story. Just maybe explain it to people.
Yeah.
There's no spoiler alerts.
Exactly.
So just explain how you did it.
Yeah. For me, I needed to explain why pain can be stronger than love. And I know that sounds strange to people, but there are times, because pain disconnects us from ourselves and it connects us from others. That's one of the big things about it. And it struck me one day that, you know, that's why torture works. That's why people use torture, because soldiers who are trained to be loyal and not give up secrets, they break under pain. And once that image came into mind, I thought, it's obvious, pain can be stronger than love, and I need to convey that. And suddenly I had this image of an astronaut, you know, kind of out on the space station doing his work, you know, in the isolation of space. But there's an accident and his equipment gets smashed up. His radio is broken, so there's no communication, and his oxygen starts running low. So he starts to be in a lot of pain, and there's no way to communicate to home base. And he feels increasingly alone. He loses his sense of gravity. He doesn't know what's up and down. And his hope is too small and his pain is too big. And what I wanted to capture in it is that the other side of that story that somebody in that state doesn't see. But I think we need to convey that you're feeling there's no hope. But all the while in the story, on every second page, it flips back to home base. And they've already sent a rescue ship. There's help on the way. There's love all around. People at home are sending radio messages, but they're not getting through. Or he's getting broken messages, they're all jumbled, and he's not hearing the message. And so for me, I really wanted to convey right in the middle of the story, then there's a call for the astronaut to stay. Because I think that's the story, really. You know, I wanted for Mira to know, to be able to say, you know, when your dad felt like that, it was a bit like the astronaut. Mm. That astronaut tried to hold on for his family. He loved his family, but his hope was too small and his pain was too big.
The other thing about the book, I should say, is that it doesn't feel like a handbook. Yes. And it doesn't feel like a, quotes, resource or anything.
Yeah.
It's like a beautiful kids book, beautiful illustrations. And you know, it is a good story. What happens at the end of it is that the child is asked to write their own ending. So the rocket ship is coming. He doesn't know. He's given up hope. Yeah. What ending did Mira write?
Yeah. So the first time I gave her the option of ending it, she said, they picked him up and they put him on the ship and they all went home laughing, eating pizza and drinking apple juice. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, she knows her dad died. I don't need her to say they got there too late and the astronaut was dead. She knows that. She doesn't have to repeat that. And that's why it was important for me. It makes the book safe for young people. They know what happened in their lives.
Okay.
But using creativity and their imagination gives them the possibility to hold the sad reality together with an imaginary alternative world. And that's how we hold difficult emotions. And that's important.
Okay. Is it easier to tell a complicated story like that to a child through a story, a metaphor? Or, like, should we be hitting them between the eyes with the reality of things?
It's a great question. It's both and.
Okay.
So for me, you need the concrete reality and you have to use the right words. So you say dead and you don't use euphemisms. You don't say gone to sleep. So it has to start with honesty and concrete words. But so that's the what and the how.
Okay.
So they need to understand death as the basic. But to help them process the enormity and to feel their emotions and to integrate and make meaning of that loss for themselves, that's where imagination and story and metaphor and softer ways work for us. And that's in terms of theory, that's how we make meaning. But historically, that's how humans have made meaning.
Yeah.
We make meaning with each other in community through telling stories.
Yeah.
And the thing about making meaning and storytelling is it's about making connections. A story tells us something like this happened to somebody else, so I'm not alone. And that's the importance of art and stories and literature. In our darkest times, they remind us, yes, somebody else's story isn't exactly like ours, but there's something like what happened, and it means I'm not the only one this happened to, and that can make pain bearable.
Do you and Mira have an especially tight mother and daughter relationship these days. She's 10 now,
She's 10 now. Yeah. And I think it's fair to say we're especially tight. And I suppose it's inevitable, you know. And anybody who's been through so much, you know, you're going to bond in a particularly tight way. And we're both, I think, just when you encounter death, anybody who does, you become, you're just so sensitized to the how delicate life is and how precious it is. So we appreciate each other in ways that you don't necessarily, you know, when you haven't.
And what kind of a kid is she? What's her personality like?
Oh, she's very funny. Yeah. She's like a sarcastic old lady. She's got she's a wise head, so she's an old soul, but she loves sarcasm and wordplay. So she's and my mum was really sarcastic and had a dark humour, so she got that off her nanny, and so she brings that with her and carries it. But she's just, and I know everybody, you know, kids are so joyful, but she sees the best in everybody, you know. And you know, she'll pick me up if I'm being grumpy, or I'd say, you know, somebody, you know, the neighbour is asking for something, and she said, well, you know, like, everybody needs help sometimes, mammy, you know, like, just, you should make some time to help, and maybe they're going through something. She's very understanding, you know.
Does she remember much about back when she was 2, 3 and all this was happening?
She remembered more when she was younger.
Yeah.
And that's consistent with kids and memory. And as life has piled in, the new memories have taken hold, and the architecture of her brain doesn't allow for those earlier memories. So she has traces of memories and slight images, and she remembers like a dragonfly, and she'll remember her dad tickling her. She has felt memories. She'll remember laughing, but not massive ones. And that's a source of sadness for her. You know, she wishes she could remember more.
Yeah.
You know?
And then what about you, Trudy? I spoke to Katrina O'Sullivan, you know, the author of Poor, recently, about complicated grief, and when you lose somebody and you have ambivalent feelings around them. And so your husband died by suicide 3 months after you had separated. You and Mira had moved out at home, obviously. I'm sure you had all kinds of emotions around it as well, did you?
Yeah, and it's hugely complicated. Because, you know, you leave a relationship and you're processing your own thoughts about it, and you're on your own high horse, you know, that you're right or whatever for that process. But when somebody dies, your feelings are no longer important. You know, you're still alive. So everything must become around honouring what they were feeling and going through. But at the same time, you're still a regular human.
Yeah.
Feeling all of those conflicting thoughts.
Does that make you feel guilty?
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, it's so common, even when there's deep love and still, you know, strong bonds, when somebody dies by suicide, guilt comes through. But when there's been a conflict and then a suicide comes after that, it's almost inevitable that there'll be guilt, you know.
And did other people try and make you feel guilty? Like, did some people blame you?
Yeah, definitely. There was explicit blame at times. Yeah, you know. And I think it's Jacqueline Connolly, in her book, she talks about it seems to be a common thing, especially for women who've lost husbands or partners, to be under a lens of suspicion that what did you do wrong that your partner felt so bad that they chose this, you know?
Do you feel a bit silenced then around that as well?
Yeah.
Maybe you can't say what you need to say.
Yeah, you definitely can't say what you need to say, because, you know, to the person who has died has lost so much.
Yeah.
So there's no way that you can speak about any of your own smaller, sad, negative, painful emotions. They seem so insignificant in beside a death. And, you know, and once somebody dies, you can never speak badly about it. You know, you can't speak bad about the dead. So there is an ultimate closing of the book, and the story ends there, where the story would have continued, you know, in a regular separation.
Yeah.
And it continues and it evolves. And often in a regular separation or conflict, there's often a resolution eventually.
Yeah.
But the book closes and the story is over and there's a silence imposed, I suppose.
This is an area that there has been a bit of controversy around in the past, like in public discourse. For people listening, is it okay if they get angry sometimes at the person?
Yeah, and I think it's very important. And I think the controversy has come around, you know, in the history of suicide, people have either been valorized or blamed when they die by suicide. And they're not the only two options. The middle ground is you can disagree with the behaviour, but still honour the pain that the person went through. But I think as a culture, we need to disagree with suicide as an option. And the people who feel angry when they're left by suicide and bereaved by suicide, that anger is about the pain that they feel and the deep loss. Like the anger is a reflection of the love you had for that person.
Yeah.
It's not an anger at the person exclusively. It's an anger and a disagreement with the decision to take your life and to take yourself out of the world. Because when you take yourself out of the world, you're not taking away the pain. The pain transfers to the people who are left behind. And what we know about suicide as well is it touches people in the community who you don't even know. There's the inner circle of the immediate family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that pain and losses and the burden of the loss is obvious. But often people who hear about the death in the community are deeply wounded by it. And we know that suicide has a contagion factor, that there's a predictor that, you know, kind of knowing people who've died by suicide can be a risk factor for completing suicide yourself. So when we die by suicide, we're leaving a legacy of making that an option. And I think that's the thing that makes me angry around it. It spreads through the community as a viable option. And we need each other.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, we need to stay for each other.
Yeah. Okay. So there are going to be some people listening now who have had or are having suicidal thoughts. What would you say to them?
The best thing I can say comes from Jennifer Michael Hecht is a writer who wrote about this, and she's felt suicidal herself. And she speaks to the need to stay, and she said, we need to have respect for our future selves. We don't know what our future selves might know or what they might experience. And we also need to have respect for the people around. We have no idea, and we have no way of knowing how much we mean to other people. We can't know that. And we have to understand that we're actually not individuals. There's webs of connection. And when we leave the world, we don't just leave a U-size shape hole. You leave a black hole. And that sucks other people into it, because all the people where we have micro connections with and big connections with are impacted by the light that we take from the world. We take light from our connections as well.
How does Mira feel about the book and about you talking to me this morning?
She's happy about the book, and she's excited that we're talking about it and that it's out there. She feels that it's her story. She feels a lot of ownership of the book. So it's her story. It's not my story.
And she has a picture in the book as well.
Yeah. And I think that was part of it. Was a difficult how much of her to put in the book, but also to honour that it is her story. So she illustrated one of the pictures, which she would like me to say happened when she was 7, and her drawing is much more sophisticated and developed now that she's 10.
Well, listen, for 7, Mira, pretty good, pretty good. I didn't really notice any difference between the professional pictures and that picture until I went back and looked properly. She sounds like an extraordinary kid, and she has an absolutely extraordinary mother. Like, truly, every word you said there was almost perfect. I don't think there was a wrong note there. And you took so many complicated, difficult things and just made them make sense. And the book does the same thing. It's terrific. It's called The Way Home by Trudy Meehan. It's illustrated by Fergal O'Connor. It's available as a free download from the RCSI library repository, but hard copies are available for free or $6.99 if you can afford it from thewayhome.ie, and we'll put a link to that on our own website, rte.ie/Brendan. And if you've been affected by this conversation, you will find support resources at rte.ie/helplines. Trudy, I haven't even looked at all the texts that have come in there now, but I know that you did something invaluable for lots of people this morning. Thank you very much, Trudy.
Thanks, Brendan.